Bankless Nation, welcome to the first week of April. It's time for the Bankless Weekly Roll-Up. Google released a major quantum warning directed squarely at us, David. Not you and me, but at crypto, let's say. They have an algorithmic breakthrough that just 20x'd progress towards cracking ECDSA and some of the crypto signatures that underlie Bitcoin, Ethereum, and basically everything we do here. How bad is it for crypto? I think it's pretty concerning. Some might call me a panickin, though. We'll get into the paper and see what Bankless listeners decide.
It's certainly worse for crypto when we can't seemingly come to consensus about how big of a deal it is, which makes it bigger deal. It's like a little bit of a coordination problem, if you will. Meanwhile, back into the Trump side of things, he addressed the nation last night about the state of the Iran war, the state of Operation Epic Fury. And my take was that it was a 19-minute speech basically to just deliver the bad news to the markets that we are in this for three more weeks, he said. We're going to talk about that, all that and more. He said the Strait of Hormuz will just open up naturally. Gas prices will come down and stock prices will go back up, but not before 3 weeks from now at the very least.
We'll see if the market is reassured by that when we get into it. Also, did Ethereum just come up with a plan to finally unite all of the layer twos? They're called Ethereum Economic Zones. We'll spell out what that means. Aave V4 just released. What's new in that? Also, the biggest hack, I think, in Solana history, a $300 million hack. The Drift Exchange, this is a perps exchange, was hacked. What happened and what can we learn? It's all about the lessons we learn along the way, isn't it?
Before we get started, Ryan, can I tell you a fun fact?
Yeah, if it genuinely needs to be fun, though. I don't want any of your, like, not fun facts, okay? This needs to be a fun one.
It's fun because it implies good buying prices.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a bearish fun fact.
Yeah.
Tell me.
We just survived the worst Q1 in Bitcoin since 2018.
Oh my God. This was it?
Can I give you another fun fact?
Wait, how, like, what was the percent down?
Down 24% in Q1.
And that was the worst Q1 we've ever had since 2018,
yeah.
That wasn't that bad.
Great. 2018, like the market topped December 2017, and then it fell like, I think, 60% in Q1 2018. I remember that Q1 very, very well because that was my foray into crypto. But my second fun fact for you, Ryan, is that Bitcoin had 5 red monthly candles in a row, but March, which the March candle finished 2 days ago, eked out a green candle.
Is that it? Is that that,
so
that tiny thing?
We have the monthly candle for the month of March was green after 5 red monthly candles. 5 red monthly candles in Bitcoin I think that's happened a very low number of times.
David, I got to say that is a tiny green candle right there. That is a
but
candle for ants.
But it is green.
Okay,
it's
is
a
green.
Tiny green candle, but it is green.
The smallest green candle, I think, on this chart, maybe. But yeah. It was green in March. That's good news. You mentioned in the intro the Trump speech that happened on Wednesday night. So he said he was going to address the nation. I think he gave some 24-hour advance notice.
Yeah.
All TV networks have to broadcast it. What was the news? What did he say?
Yeah, so 19-minute speech about Operation Epic Fury, the war in Iran. After a week of just like posturing from Trump, 2 weeks even, about posturing about negotiation talks, how negotiation talks are going well, talking about how he's kind of done with Iran and de-escalation.
Like weird stuff. Like it was hard to know what was really going on, right?
Well, no, I would say he was firmly posturing and signaling to the people in the market that, like, we're kind of wrapping this thing up.
Yeah.
Right? We're like, we're getting
yeah, but
office.
He was doing it Trump style. Like, I got a prize, you know, from the Iranians.
Yeah.
Like, some strange, it was hard to know, actually, to sort the signal through the noise. So was this the signal?
So then, yes, this is a very formal speech. So he's like, this is the speech. These aren't my, you know, true social posts. This isn't Mark Rubio.
I prepared this.
this is the speech.
Okay.
And so the market was going into this thinking like, okay, this is Donald Trump like tying a bow on this thing, kind of giving us the exit plan, wrapping it up, you know, concluding it. That was, I think, my interpretation of both market's anticipation, you know, Twitter's anticipation. Instead, I think what came out of this, my take, is that the whole purpose of this talk was to drop this one line, and I'll read that line that I think was the whole point right now. We are on track to complete all of America's objectives very shortly. We are going to hit Iran extremely hard in the next 2 to 3 weeks. We are going to bring them back to the Stone Age where they belong. I think the whole 19 minutes was basically to inform the public that we are in this for 3 more weeks. And the market reacted appropriately right after he said those lines. The oil markets shot up 10%. Brent crude went up 10%. WTI went up 12%. Futures, the NASDAQ and S&P 500 futures dropped 0.5%. He said a few other things as well. He said that the stock market didn't really go down all that much. He said that the stock market was, he thought it was going to go down more than it actually did. And so we're going to be down a little bit longer. And then they're going to go back up like never before, he said, after this 3-week period.
That's a direct quote.
That was a direct quote. That's right. Yeah. And so this is, the market is currently digesting this as of right now. This is the morning after that speech. But this is my take, is like he basically just gave a 19-minute speech about why we need to be in Iran for 3 more weeks.
Wow. That line, we're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong. That's so Trumpian.
Yeah. Not the first time he said that.
Geez. Okay. Well, he didn't say we're going to leave in 2 to 3 weeks. He just said we're going to hit them hard in the next two to three weeks. And you think the market is interpreting that as we're also going to exit in 2 to 3 weeks?
No, I think the market was interpreting that we are going to exit like this week at the end of this week. We're done with this thing. And then Trump is telling them, like, no, we got 2 to 3 more weeks. And I think it's safe to round up to 3 on that scenario. But to your point, I think you're right. He did not say that we're out in 3 weeks either.
This is a poly market on U.S. forces entering Iran by a specific date. And by April 30th, poly market is showing on 18 million in volume. There's about a 60% chance that U.S. forces enter Iran. That means boots on the ground, does it not?
Yes, I think boots on the ground by the end of this month, poly market is giving a 60% chance.
A probability on poly market for U.S. and Iran ceasefire by a specific date, 60% by June 30th, 47% by May 31st. So end of May, almost a 50% chance into the summer. December 31st, a 73% chance. So, I mean, that's like a 27% chance that this isn't over by the end of this year.
All year, yeah.
Are the markets pricing that in?
I mean, we can talk about the efficient
markets
market
always price
hypothesis.
Everything in, don't they?
Yeah,
they're super
efficient.
They always
all the time. That's right. Like, the growing conversation is around midterms, the midterm elections that are coming up later this year. So I think we have like just under 6 months before the midterms start to become, are here. And I mean, who knows what Trump is thinking? I certainly don't. But it's to be argued that there's no way that Trump wants the Iran war at all to be proximate to the midterms.
He doesn't want that. Now, does Trump always get what he wants?
He's also Trump. You know, we don't really know.
Well, there's also a question of like once you are in it, right? You know, there are some forces that like he doesn't control. Yeah. Of course,
he doesn't control
right?
the universe.
Exactly, including the Straits of Hormuz. So, looking at some charts, I mean, this is volatile, so things are changing in a hurry. But Brent crude up by 10%. Mm-hmm. So this was directly after the speech.
Right afterwards.
Oil
right.
shot up. Mm-hmm. Bond markets, the 10-year T-bill note back on its way to $4.4% yield, right? Remember we talked about, I think it was last week, as those yields those yield numbers tick up on the 10-year, that's more pressure on Trump. And you kind of saw them back in the tariff scare of last year, 4.6%, that started to feel very uncomfortable. And Trump walked back his tariff language. So this is another pressure on him. Of course, crypto prices, what are we doing here, man? So Bitcoin down 4%, ETH down 6%. Hard to know if that is swirled up in all of this or what's going on. But now the S&P is trading kind of like neutrally. Is that the case?
Yeah. So S&P dropped, futures dropped by 0.5%. And now at the time of recording, the S&P is actually flipped green, marginally green. So we are actually at the same stock market prices, at least in the S&P, as we were before the Trump speech. I have a take on this, which is that the longer that the market has to digest the news being the war, the whole entire Iran war, the more it kind of comes normalized. And we saw this with the Liberation Day tariffs. Markets reacted violently at the very beginning. And every single time there was another tariff day tweet or, you know, posturing against China or announcement on further tariffs on China, the market reacted, but it reacted in a more muted fashion as time went on. And I'm seeing that with Iran here too. Like the market is reacting, but it's starting to shrug it off quicker and quicker and quicker. And we all kind of remember what happened with the Liberation Day tariffs. Like eventually the market just stopped caring and then we went to new all-time highs. Every single new crisis is facts and circumstances. So we can't really say that's going to be repeated. But with the S&P being green as of this morning, after Trump told us that they're going to strike Iran hard for the next 3 weeks and the stock market comes out green, I'm kind of interested in that pattern.
I mean, I guess like, it's hard to know what the market is thinking, but there are some forces that have to impact the market, which is like one of which is oil. And yes. So if Strait of Hormuz is closed for longer, oil prices spike. Here's an analysis from the Kobayashi letter. As oil prices rise above 112 per barrel, our models indicate that if current levels are sustained, so if you have that oil price another 2 months, US CPI inflation will rise to 3.6%. So energy costs are going to affect inflation. And of course, that's going to affect what the Fed does. That could, Michael Nadeau makes the point that that could spiral into lower growth in the US, and the possibility of a recession is actually up on the air from like 20% to 36%, according to Polymarket. And you also have Lynn Alden, who is talking about this. Some people ask me when I'll be chill about energy. She said, I'm looking at my oil quant guy and he's not chill. He has to become chill again. And he is the opposite of chill right now. She is posting a tweet from Rory Johnston, who I presume is Lynn Alden's oil quant person. And he is talking about a scenario which he calls the air pocket scenario, which as supply is restricted from the Strait of Hormuz, it's like a scarcity air pocket that affects different geographies.
After that takes time to get there. That's
it
why
takes
it's like
time to propagate, yeah. Right? So it might take if that happens right now, deliveries could stop on April 15th in North America, but they stop far earlier in Africa and place it in Asia. And so this is like an air pocket that makes its way throughout the energy economy. So I don't know. It still seems to depend on the Strait of Hormuz. Some of these factors are not in Trump's control, but it seems like he's getting the narrative right, at least for the market right now. They're believing him.
Yeah. Yeah. And this all is going to show up in inflation. Like, what does oil have to do with the bonds? Well, higher oil prices makes everything cost more domestically in our neck of the woods. If things cost more domestically, that means inflation's going up. That means the Fed's going to hike interest rates. And we just had this clip, this statement out from Powell, basically saying that the United States national debt is growing substantially faster than the economy and it's not sustainable. And so that goes into, can the United States service its own debt? And so the cost that Iran knows that it's posting to America through the closing the Hormuz, Strait of Hormuz, is that we can't pay our debt. I actually thought this clip from Fed Chair Jerome Powell was actually pretty interesting. Let's go ahead and watch it.
What's clear is that our debt is growing much faster. The federal government debt is growing substantially faster than our economy. And that ratio is going up. And, you know, in the long run, that's kind of the definition of unsustainable. The level of the debt is not unsustainable, but the path is not sustainable. And so it's really important that we get back to, we don't have to pay the debt down. We just need to have, you know, primary balance and begin to have the economy actually growing better, growing more quickly than the economy. It will not end well if we don't do something fairly soon. This is not the Fed's job, of course, and I pretty much limit myself to those high-level points, which essentially everyone ignores.
He limits himself to those points that everyone ignores. It will not end well if we don't do something fairly soon. He can't say more, but he's basically blaming deficits. Yeah. He's blaming fiscal on this and general overspending coming out of the federal government.
Yeah. So all of this is to say that there's a lot of evidence for why this war can't sustain itself over a long period of time. I think the speech that we got from Trump last night is like, I've got 3 more weeks. I've got 3 more weeks before this really hurts.
You think that's him acknowledging I have maybe 3 more weeks?
I think he, not in that speech, but I think he knows that. He knows he doesn't have forever.
He definitely knows that. I mean, he knows he doesn't have forever. That. He's probably seen these sorts of stats too. This is from Nate Silver, which is Trump's approval rating. It just fell below 40% for the first time. And you could see Trump's numbers on a trend down from the liberation tariffs and, you know, some of these other milestones, the government shutdown, Rene Good killed, the Iran war starts, and it's been on a steady trajectory down, which is not great when you're in a midterm year. And this is showing up in probabilities for the election. So ever since, let's say, well, ever since November, but there's been a steady trickle up as Trump favorability goes down. The odds that the Democrats will win the House in 2026 are going up. On Polymarket right now, that's 86%. The Senate
on $4 million of volume, which isn't super high, but definitely not low either.
Yeah. And the Senate is more up for grabs. It's about 50-50 right now. So there's some political constraints. There's some economic constraints, and all of this is getting factored in. But so far, I don't think we've really felt the shock in the markets. I mean, crypto prices is down and that aside, but I don't think the NASDAQ has gotten hit to the degree that some have thought it might. And it may still soon.
Yeah, that was actually an explicit point that Trump was making, was like he explicitly said a number of times in his speech last night is like, we don't need the Strait of Hormuz. We've got our own oil. We've got WTI. We got West Texas International. And then he also did the whole thing. It was like, Europe, like, this is your guys' problem. You guys need to step in here. So, but he explicitly says, like, we've got our supply of oil. Like, our economy is going to be fine. And we also do see that in the global stock market indices. It's like the domestic United States markets are doing much better than the international markets.
So let's leave it there for the week. Coming up next, we got to talk about quantum. Is quantum getting ready to come in and just wreck Bitcoin, Ethereum, all our cryptocurrencies? Or is this just FUD, David? Are we being alarmist here? We got to get into the quantum papers, the research released this week by Google and one other. There's so many details to cover. We'll talk about that when we come back.
If you're already holding Sol, here's something you may want to pay attention to. Galaxy One just launched Solana staking, and you can earn up to an estimated 6.5% in variable staking rewards on your Sol with no platform commission fee charged throughout December 31st, 2026. While many other platforms charge up to 35% commission fees on staking rewards, Galaxy One offers you 0% platform commission through December 31st. Other fees may apply. You should see the terms. This is powered by Galaxy Digital's own validator infrastructure, one of the largest Solana validator operations in the world, and now available to individual investors directly within the Galaxy One platform. Once you stake, rewards accrue and compound automatically. No active management needed. You can track everything in one place, including balances, rewards, and tax reporting through TaxBit. Getting started is straightforward. You can buy Sol directly in the app or transfer it in. If you want to put your Sol to work, you can now start staking on Galaxy One today. Click the link in the show notes to learn more and get started. Not investment advice. Bankless isn't just a name. It's a genuine belief that you shouldn't need permission from an institution to use your money. MetaMask has been around since the beginning of Ethereum, and they carry the same DNA we do. MetaMask was my first wallet, and well, if you haven't opened up the app recently, let me tell you, they've been shipping, creating the one app to finally replace your bank and exchange. You can trade just about everything right from within MetaMask. Leverage perps via Hyperliquid, prediction markets through Polymarket, tokenized stocks like Nvidia, and you can swap tokens gaslessly and across networks, and even spend your crypto with your MetaMask card at real merchants all around the world. It's better than institution services, but from a self-custodial wallet. And this is what we've been talking about for years. Money that's open and is happening. So give MetaMask trading features a look at the link below. So on Monday, a quantum bomb was dropped by two different papers. One out of Google and another out of a bunch of academics. We'll call it the second one, the Oratomic paper. Ryan, I know you were paying attention to this. How would you summarize the significance of these papers?
Oh my God, incredibly significant. I think calling it a Q-bomb, a quantum bomb, is probably right. It's the biggest...
Nice, I just made that up on the fly.
Well, everyone in crypto was talking about it. Mainstream news was talking about it. We have a lot of commentators outside who have weighed in. It was basically the news of the week, and deservedly so. I think we should start here with Justin Drake, some of his comments. He said, today, he's talking about when these papers dropped, today is a momentous day for quantum computing and cryptography. Two breakthrough papers just landed. Both papers improve Shor's algorithm, infamous for cracking RSA, not Ryan Sean Adams, the other RSA, and elliptic curve cryptography. The two results compound, optimizing separate layers of the quantum stack. The results are shocking, he said. I expect a narrative shift and further R&D boost towards post-quantum cryptography. He goes on to say, his confidence in Q-Day, which is the day at which some quantum computer can crack Bitcoin or Ethereum cryptography, 10% chance by 2032 and dropping for Justin Drake. So Google in this paper is strongly recommending that all of crypto take notice and be on notice and to upgrade to post-quantum by the year 2029. In fact, that's what Google is doing internally.
Wait, so Google made an explicit statement towards the crypto industry.
This whole paper, David, was specifically written for the crypto industry. They're like,
hey, crypto bros, this one's for you guys.
Completely. And
wow.
the knowledge
nice
it was
to be
like,
heard.
Yeah, it is nice to be heard. It was nice. Like, this is coming from Google, right?
Yeah,
and you don't
yeah.
expect them to be as cryptocurrency literate as they were indeed. Mm-hmm. But this paper, I mean, it's 30 to 40 pages. You guys can go through it, run it through your AI bots if you'd like. But it is directed towards cryptocurrency. They go through specific
right.
solutions and problems for Bitcoin, Ethereum, and a list of other chains as well.
So what was the actual innovation?
Yeah, I think that's important. And the way Nick Carter frames this is, Google, I think we reported a couple of weeks ago, did drop their internal quantum deadlines. They want to be fully quantum resistant by mm-hmm. 2029. And that seemed to come out of nowhere. And the question is, like, what did Google see? Why did
right.
they drop these dates? Because NIST and other government agencies were talking 2032 by
right.
2035. It seemed like we had more time. And then Google's like, hey, guys, like, we're doing it by 2029. So what did they see? This is what they saw. The Google paper is talking about a reduction of 20x and an improvement in Shor's algorithm that could break Bitcoin and Ethereum's cryptography. When I say a 20x improvement, I'm talking about the number of physical qubits required to actually break ECDSA, which is the signature scheme for Bitcoin and Ethereum. It
and
used
physical
to be,
qubits is like, this is the hardware requirement.
Exactly.
Like, so when we're building a quantum computer, though I kind of think of qubits as like just like the flop capacity of a CPU. Like, how
yeah.
powerful is this computer?
Exactly.
And so if we have a reduction in qubits, it means the computer is simply not as powerful, but can do more powerful things.
That's right. And previous estimates were it would take, tens of millions of qubits to do this. Well, they just released an improvement to the algorithm, to Shor's algorithm, that now make it take only 500,000 physical qubits. And so in a runtime of about 9 minutes, if they had the appropriate hardware, again, those 500,000 physical qubits, it would only take 9 minutes for them to go attack Bitcoin or Ethereum and yoink the keys. And also, this is not just limited to, grabbing quantum vulnerable assets from Bitcoin or Ethereum or other chains. It also enables on-spend attacks. So they can intercept transactions before they confirm. Within the block time of something like Bitcoin, within 9 minutes, they could intercept a transaction. Say, I send Bitcoin from myself to you, a quantum computer with this amount of hardware could go and yoink and intercept that transaction. So this breaks Bitcoin, basically,
mm-hmm.
and also breaks everything else. It breaks Ethereum. It breaks everything in crypto if we had that level of hardware.
Right. If we had the level of hardware. Now, to my understanding, that is still the unknown thing, is whether we can actually get to that level of hardware. Right now, we have the best machines that we have today are like 1,000 to 1,500 physical qubits, and that creates 50 logical qubits. These are all deep quantum scientific stuff.
That's right.
But it's still an unknown if we can get to a meaningful level of logical qubits. Like,
that's
we're
right.
at 50, we need a lot more. But what this innovation does from this paper is it's just simply an improvement in the software. An improvement in the algorithm. That means we
yes.
don't actually need a whole lot more qubits. We definitely need way more qubits, but the amount of qubits that we need is now down because we have a more efficient piece of software.
That's exactly right. That's the thing to underline, is this is an algorithm improvement that mm-hmm. reduces the amount of hardware required to go attack these systems. And so it is still an engineering problem. I was wanting to ask this question of like, how big of an engineering problem is it? Is this something like fusion, which like that's
right.
an engineering problem, but we have no idea how to solve fusion.
Sure, yeah.
It's always like
mm-hmm.
15 years away
yeah,
or whatever.
It's always theory, never practice.
Yeah,
and,
or is it
And as
like,
I understand it, quantum is still theory, not practice when it comes to qubits. We do have some qubits.
We do. We have 50 logical qubits right now. And the question is, can we scale that up? And I don't think it's not like fusion, which is just like, oh, there's a lot more research to do. This is purely an engineering problem. Now, can we resolve the engineering problem? I don't know. But it seems more like AI scaling, which is you just throw more hardware at it. You just scale it up than it does fusion. It's almost like an analog is in the 1960s, transistors worked. They were discovered. The question at that time was, could we pack millions on one chip? And that was the engineering problem.
Yes.
That's similar to what the engineering problem is now. So their conclusion, Google's conclusion, we urge all vulnerable cryptocurrency communities, which is all of us, to join the migration to post-quantum computing cryptography without delay. Didn't mention, but the other paper, the Oratomic paper, it's actually, they have a different architecture and a different style attack. There's a fast attack, which Google was talking about, and a slower attack that would take days to go attack a key. But with the slower attack in their message, in their method, they improved Shor's algorithm by 50x. So in this configuration, it would only take 10,000 reconfigurable atomic qubits to attack. So there's multiple attack vectors. And at some level, the Oratomic paper. And the Oratomic paper was even more concerning. So flashing red lights, you'd think.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a flashing red light for ecosystems that aren't addressing the problem. But Ryan, we're smart, logical people in crypto, right? We're addressing the problem, are we not?
I'm not so sure. I mean, so let's talk about Bitcoin, right? So one of the big problems we talked about in the Justin Drake episode, we've mentioned a lot, is even if Bitcoin is able to adopt post-quantum signatures, which would significantly slow things down from a performance perspective, and that's a problem in and of itself. In fact, the paper talks about this could be at like the level of change that led to the hard fork that created Bitcoin Cash. Right, because if you drop performance with new algorithms, then what are you? Are you a big blocker or a small blocker? There could be two sides to that debate.
Yeah, so just to trace over that again, quantum signatures, post-quantum cryptographic signatures, the ones that we need to upgrade to, are beefier, they're heavier, they take more space,
slower.
Require more compute, they're slower. Yeah. And Bitcoin has already gone through its block size wars and these small blockers won, which is fine. Maybe that was the right choice for then. What potentially happens now is that with even bigger transactions, Bitcoin TPS is going to go from 3 transactions per second to, if it makes the transition to post-quantum, 0.3 transactions per second. Do we need to even hash out the big block, small block war again?
Right.
Maybe not, because... Yeah, I could say it just like you just actually just don't need to transact on Bitcoin. You just need to hold the Bitcoins. And maybe this also solves the Bitcoin fee budget with 0.3 transactions per second.
Oh, yeah. It's great for fees.
I think there's an argument for the small blocker side of things.
If only that was the only problem. The other, I think the main problem as well, I don't know, they're all main problems, is you've got 6.9 million Bitcoin, a third of all supply that is vulnerable to quantum attack. Now, some of that can be migrated, except for the 2.3 million or so, which is 10 to 15% of all Bitcoin supply, that is Satoshi's keys and lost keys and keys that haven't been touched and is presumed lost.
These are assumed tokens that will never move because the owner is gone or dead or the private keys are lost. And so the only way that they will move is that these wallets are going to get exploited eventually by the incoming quantum computer. And then whoever has that quantum computer gains access to 2.3 million out of the 21 million Satoshi coins. And that is the guaranteed number that is available to the quantum computer. And then there's the 6.9 million, again, of the 21 million total Bitcoins. That is Bitcoin that is vulnerable, that needs to be migrated. And we do not know to what degree that those coins are also lost, at least some.
And so what do you do with the dormant coins? Actually, Google delved into this as well in their paper.
Dude,
and they're like,
nice
there's
job,
four
Google.
Options you guys have that we see. We are Google and we see four options. I should say there were other co-authors on this paper, one of which was Justin Drake, interestingly enough. So the Ethereum Foundation, Justin Drake named. But anyway, they said the four options are you could do nothing, just let the quantum attackers take them. You could burn. You could take this whole dormant supply, figure out what, get consensus on what coins are dormant and burn them all.
That would require a hard fork.
Yes, you could do an hourglass approach, which is a scheme that they developed to limit the rate that dormant coins could be spent. So you slow the drain. Or this was also a Justin Drake idea. They called it bad sidechain, where you'd have this pegged sidechain. You'd put all the dormant coins on that. And then owners would have to submit some ownership proofs. And if they submitted the right proof, they could get their coins restored to them.
I see. So that is kind of, that is the burn, but with a escape hatch for people who actually do have the private key.
That's right.
Yeah.
See, I like that one. I would do that one.
I do kind of like that one. But I do kind of like that one.
I don't get
that
to
decide. That requires the most coordination, which is the biggest challenge for Bitcoiners.
Yes. Now, CZ has weighed in, at least at this early phase. And he said this about, he's number one, don't panic. Some people are panicking about quantum. Don't panic about that and its impact to crypto. Number two, what do we do with the Satoshi coins? Well, if they don't move in a certain period of time, it might be better to lock or effectively burn those addresses so they don't go to the hacker who cracks it. That's it. Just lock them or burn them. And I was like shocked at how nonchalant this answer was from CZ. It's just like
burn 3 million Bitcoins.
That's a big deal, right? Yeah. That's property rights. You know, that is the reason that Bitcoin exists, I thought.
Yeah.
They also talk about Ethereum, of course. So the TLDR for Ethereum is the attack surface is much larger than Bitcoin, right? And so it's like a harder problem to solve because
engineering problem to solve.
Yes. You're not just dealing with execution, ECDSA signatures. Yeah. You've got data availability, vulnerability. So the KZG ceremony that they did, that's all toxic waste. That's all a backdoor. You've got admin accounts. So stablecoins, some of the smart contract keys for stablecoins have quantum exposed admin keys. So there's all sorts of things that you have to upgrade on Ethereum that you don't have to upgrade to Bitcoin. So I don't know if it's an order of magnitude of a larger task. I don't think it's quite that much, but it's probably like a 2 or 3x effort.
Engineering effort, you mean?
Engineering effort and just like the work required. Right.
The work required, yes. Qualitatively, Bitcoin has a coordination and a consensus problem.
Yes.
And Ethereum, like some of these things, like admin vulnerability for something, for example, 200 billion in stable coins and real world assets controlled by quantum exposed admin keys. Well, the admins just need to do the thing.
That's right.
And there's a lot of those examples, but it's a matter of just like, hey, you guys are the admin over this smart contract. You guys need to upgrade. And I mean, they will because they have $200 billion at stake. And so while that's an engineering challenge, it's not really a coordination challenge in the same way that Bitcoin is. And so, yes, broadly, there's more to do on Ethereum. Like you said, maybe 2 to 3x more to do. Maybe even I could go up to 5x.
Could you?
But it's qualitatively a different kind of problem because there's less of a coordination and
it
an agreement
is. And,
problem.
And you don't have to deal with a big thing, which is property rights. What do you do with 10 to 15% of the supply? Like there's no good answer for Bitcoin there. And actually, Google makes the same assessment. They said Ethereum has a broader overall quantum attack surface than Bitcoin. However, this is compensated by stronger community leadership in the Ethereum Foundation. Ethereum already has a roadmap for this.
Yeah.
Bitcoin is kind of like, are quantum computers real? Are they
Bitcoin
real?
Is still in the
probably
don't look
real.
Up phase.
Yes.
They're like the Bitcoin zealots, the laser-eyed maxis are like, shut up. This is not a problem.
Yeah, I
everyone
can't hear
stop
you, blah, blah, blah.
This. Da, da, yeah. Da, 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 da.
Yeah. We'll give you some like takes on the takes later, but they also mentioned some other chains. So Zcash, they said it was likely a first target. They mentioned stealth inflation attacks that are available. Also, Monero, if you're on Monero, all of the private transactions could be yielded public like this with a quantum computer. Yes.
Are you serious?
Yes, David. So all of your nefarious transactions on Monero.
Every illegal
I hope you
action
weren't up to
on
no good, my
Monero
friend.
Is going to be revealed.
Yes. Yes.
That's
now
gonna
some
be
chains
juicy.
Are ready for this. Algorand is ready. They're already ready. So
nice.
There you go.
Nice
maybe
job,
that's
Algorand.
A boon for Algorand. Solana, they said. It's similar to Ethereum, but they have less institutional inertia. They'll be able to implement it. They released proof that the 20x algorithm, Shor's algorithm improvement was like a real thing, not by publishing the algorithm itself and how they did it,
because
they
said
that would be too dangerous.
Yeah, because they're just giving the secrets.
Yeah.
They proved that they could do it, but they're not releasing those secrets to anyone else.
So they use a succinct ZK proof in order to prove that. So they didn't tell you how they did it, but they did prove that they do have a 20x improved algorithm for Shor's for cracking this type of thing. Crazy.
You gotta know that China is like, somebody go get that secret.
Oh my God, that's a great point, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it's also a point that we are beyond the days where this is going to be released publicly. So there's like, quantum is a military weapon, isn't it? So if Google is releasing this quasi-publicly, they're saying we have the capability, but they're not showing you how. What are nation states actors doing about this like today? Because remember, this technology allows them to spy on their neighbors. Like it's a military grade technology. So that is kind of the scary thing. Nick Carter reminds us, you will not get a warning. The warning is what you are getting now. This is your warning. Once logical qubits start to meaningfully scale, you will go from cracking 5 bits to 256 bits very quickly. So Google's kind of being the good guy by telling us in advance. There might that's not the expectation necessarily. One day you could wake up and the attacks are starting.
Yeah. I think that is the mic drop moment, is that this is the warning shot. This is the shot across the bow, and we probably won't be getting any more.
All right. Now, I'll dampen that a little bit. There's some takes around crypto. This one's from Anatoly, founder of Solana. He did remind us that we still have no clue on how to manufacture and add qubits. So this getting from 5 logical qubits to 1,400 qubits, we don't actually know how to do that from an engineering perspective. We don't know if that scales yet. And it could be the case that there's some impossibility in the world of meat space that just makes that very, very difficult or decades out.
Technically true, not something to depend on.
Kind of agree with you. But maybe you're being a panican, David, because this is the other take. It was a take from a former Bitcoin developer, which is, and you and I talked to Michael Saylor this week, and we asked him about the Google quantum paper. We did a recording with Michael Saylor, and he took this view. He said, basically, like, ignore the alarmists. There's a lot of pessimists out there that want you to feel FUD. And if you move too fast, sometimes the cure can be worse than the disease, right? So everyone calm down. Don't panic. The devs will figure a solution out. This is Jonas Schinelli. He said, don't rush, avoid the FUD. Bitcoin devs I know, they acknowledge that quantum is a risk. They're looking at researching it. Maybe it never materializes, but like, it's just, don't be all alarmist and panicking about it.
It's hard for me to take the don't be a panican, don't believe the FUD response seriously, because is this not existential for Bitcoin?
It's pretty damn important, yeah.
It's pretty important.
Yeah, and so, no, like, it's existential.
There's like a level of FUD that we all need to get on board with, because this is our industry here. And so to say, like, hey, don't panic, is like, the building's on fire. Like, sure, don't panic, but like, do rush for the exit.
Don't panic, like, but prepare, maybe.
And I don't mean exit Bitcoin. I mean, just like, go to the solution.
Yeah.
It's urgent.
Brian Armstrong seems to feel that urgency. So just this morning he posted, going to start spending time on this personally. Seems like we need to solve it sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
I don't know what the solve is actually going to be. There's so much here. This actually leaked outside of crypto Twitter as well. This is Chamath, co-host of the All In podcast. He said, I mentioned last year and the crypto bros freaked out about it. But there's two things that are true about crypto bros. They're extremely technical and extremely belief-oriented. Sometimes, though, the latter clouds the former. This paper from Google
is just talking about Bitcoiners.
And it raises some important technical questions. The crypto elders should start spending more effort organizing on a timescale that makes crypto quantum resistant, and do this in the next few years with a conclusive roadmap.
I hate it when Chamath makes the point that echoes around the world, and he's right.
What do we got coming up?
Coming up next, we're going to talk about the biggest hack on Solana. Their $285 million exploited from Drift, and we're going to talk about the lessons learned from that. Then we're going to go on to Ethereum and the EEZ, the Ethereum Economic Zones, and why that might be Ethereum 3.0. You didn't hear from us, though. And also the clearest evidence so far that X is working on a crypto wallet in their X Money super app. All of that and more. But first, we're going to talk to some of these fantastic sponsors that make the show possible. Markets are reacting to a world that feels anything but stable. Inflation is sticky, geopolitical risk is rising, and capital is moving between crypto, commodities, equities, and currencies faster than ever. A universal exchange like BitGet is built for this kind of environment. With a major app upgrade, BitGet now gives TradFi its own dedicated tab in the navigation. One click gives you access to stocks, gold, forex, and other global markets, all inside the same platform you already use for crypto. You can get 90% off trading fees on stock perps, and you can trade gold and silver without the fee burn. One app, one account. Trade crypto and traditional assets side by side without bouncing between platforms. No scattered tools, no login juggling, just a unified trading experience built for speed and flexibility. When gold is reacting to global risk, crypto is moving on liquidity, and macro headlines can shift markets overnight, you need a platform that keeps everything in one place. This is BitGet's universal exchange vision in action. If you're the kind of trader who adapts as the world changes, BitGet is built for you. Start trading crypto and TradFi in one place. Click the link in the show notes. This is not investment advice.
Some exciting news. We are launching a new podcast to help people figure out the crypto cycle, how to navigate it. The best crypto cycle investor I know, his name is Michael Nato. He runs the DeFi Report. This is the guy that sent me a sell alert before the 1010 price drop happened. His cycle analysis has been absolutely on point. I've been following him for years. And this year, we started recording weekly podcast episodes. Each one, we get into his portfolio, what he's holding, the market structure, entry targets, fair market value of Bitcoin and Ether, and where we are in the cycle. There's new episodes that are released every Wednesday. They're 30 minutes. They're short. They're punchy. I think this crypto cycle is harder to navigate than most. So let's do it together. Go subscribe to this podcast. Search the DeFi Report wherever you get your podcasts, YouTube, Apple, Spotify, or find a link in the show notes. There's a new episode waiting for you now.
On Wednesday, April 1st, Drift Protocol, which is a Solana perp dex, was exploited for $285 million. One of, if not the biggest hack on Solana. There was the wormhole hack a while ago in 2022 that was $325 million, but that was a bridge. Drift is a DeFi app on Solana, so definitely ranks up there. 50% of Drift's total TVL was drained. How did this happen? The attacker somehow got a hold of two of the five multi-sig signatures through social engineering, and they just were allowed to push a transaction through that I think some of the other multi-sig signers couldn't comprehend, and so they just pushed them to approve, which gave them control over the protocol. That's market creation, oracle assignment, withdrawal limits, and also importantly, no time locks. And so once the exploiter had access to the sufficient number of admin keys, they basically had full admin control over the protocol. Weeks before they got access to these keys, they made this fake token that they had minted and wash traded for days and days and days and days so that they could create this fake volume that made this token perceived to be real. That allowed them, once they had governance over the protocol, to add this token to the Drift protocol, and they controlled the entire supply. And so once this token was approved as collateral, they could collateralize this token and then withdraw USDC, USDT, CB Bitcoin from the protocol. All of this happened in 31 transactions over 12 minutes that resulted in $285 million getting drained. The Drift token fell 20% in the hours after the exploit was first reported.
The amount of planning that went into this, and it was like the multi-sig signers were kind of like almost like hunted, right? So again, it took two of five on this multi-sig in order to have this kind of god mode ability to drain $285 million, which is 50% of Drift's TVL. And it was a very sophisticated group that pulled this off. So someone like the Lazarus group, maybe even indeed was them. I'm not sure. I haven't seen kind of the reporting on this. And that was the vulnerability. So they were able to trick two of Drift's five multi-sig signers to sign these transactions that they didn't fully understand. And that's how this hack happened. Unfortunately for users, like the money's gone, right? So Drift hasn't come out with a way to remunerate users. Drift was not a huge perps protocol in the scheme of all perps protocols. They were kind of like top 30, but they were the biggest, I think, on Solana, at least one of the largest on Solana. And as you said, I mean, this ranks as one of the biggest hacks ever, certainly the largest on Solana. This reminded me a little bit of the Ronin sidechain hack. Mm-hmm. Do you remember 625 yeah. million? That was in 2022. That was also a multi-sig keys. Type hack.
Yeah.
Social engineering, compromised keys. Like these multi-sigs are, they are just hazardous for yeah. protocols to have in place, right? And I mean, what are the lessons that we learned from this?
There's a lot of just kind of criticism on the Drift structure, the admin setup, the multi-sig setup of Drift from some DeFi founders. So both Stani from Aave and Hayden from Uniswap said something to the effect of Drift was not DeFi. If you have admin keys that can do these sorts of things, like one single entity can govern this protocol in this particular way, that's just not DeFi. Hayden said, people might accuse me of grave dancing for saying it, but we have to stop letting centralized things call themselves DeFi. An admin key that can drain all the funds? CeFi. Otherwise, DeFi means nothing and the brand is destroyed. No admin key can drain any version of Uniswap for a reason. I think there's a point there to be taken of just the whole point of this thing is smart contracts and code. And that's the thing to aspire to. Granted, that's a very difficult thing to aspire to. And we've also learned other lessons in the inverse direction of things completely governed by code also have problems. So it's a little bit stuck between a rock and a hard place. I think the big lesson to be learned was the zero time lock, the 0 second time lock, where new governance decisions, new admin changes go into effect immediately and don't give any sort of recourse. Yeah. There should be, 24 hours, 7 days before some things take effect that would allow people to just raise a flag and be like, yo, this is not right.
Yeah, certainly. Even if you have a multi-sig, there are better ways to design it. It was only a two yeah. of five, right? You could do a five of seven or something like this.
Yeah.
Like, there's all sorts of time delays, all sorts of things you could have done. I think another lesson learned is the social engineering behind these mm-hmm. hacks is getting crazy sophisticated, right? So how they got these signers to actually sign, I don't know if that's completely known, but it could be like supply chain attacks where like mm-hmm. there's some kind of code library that they downloaded as a dependency is now infected their machine. I mean, if you're a multi-sig signer, it's you should be concerned with your setup at all times yep. and be yep. paranoid about it.
You should have a setup that does not touch anything else other than doing it one job.
Absolutely. David, there yeah. was something that big that came out of ETHCC this week that caught my eye. I want to tell you about it. Is that okay?
I would love to hear it.
Okay, so there was a dream that was the United Chains of Ethereum. You remember this?
I had this same dream.
That's what I thought we were kind of getting back
yeah,
in 2022.
Kind of what I thought with the whole idea.
So I want to take you to maybe DEF CON 2024. Do you remember when Drake gave his first kind of lean Ethereum talk?
Yeah, the five-year plan talk.
Yeah. And so there was news like Justin Drake was getting on stage. He was going to present something. I was hoping it would be a way to unite all the chains, what I was thinking of calling kind of Ethereum 3.0.
Yeah. We were memeing before it was announced. We were memeing Ethereum 3.0.
Okay. And what we meant by uniting the chains was basically synchronous composability. So the problem with the L2 roadmap and L2 strategy in general was that every L2 felt like a separate country, right? Yeah. Like it had its own borders.
It was a separate blockchain. Everything was a separate blockchain.
It felt like a separate blockchain. Sure, there was some shared security there, but like mm-hmm. when it comes to liquidity, oh, that's a separate liquidity pool. You have your right. L2 liquidity. You want to get that, you got a bridge.
18 different implementations of Uniswap, 18 different implementations of Aave, like no 1+1=3.
It was a security alliance, like a very loose federation of countries. It wasn't a united chains of Ethereum. Right. It wasn't kind of like no borders, everyone shares the same liquidity. Okay, well, the dream might be back on the menu. We'll see, but...
Am I ready to be hurt again?
Don't get your hopes up yet, but actually, I do think there's some meat on the bone here. So this is a rollout from Gnosis and also from Jordy. You remember Jordy, right?
Yeah, Jordy Bellina.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So ZK, genius. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's called EEZ. It stands for the Ethereum Economic Zone. And the promise here is that it's a way for layer twos to synchronously compose with layer one, so all shared liquidity, okay, shared fees, shared everything. So it seems seamless to be on whether on an L2 and the Ethereum economic zone or the L1, it all feels seamless, shared liquidity. It's all unified. You can get atomic transactions through, and it does indeed feel like one chain. So the way they are doing this is through technical architecture and some specifications, a sprinkling of ZK magic. You know, that's important for kind of fast withdrawals. And
to add some ZK and then you're ZK. Done.
Yep. And then developer tooling and ecosystem integration. Some of these details are going to emerge over the coming weeks. And the hope there is that you get chains to opt in. So mm-hmm. one chain that would be nice, which is currently in L1, is the Gnosis chain. So Martin, I guess one of the leads for the Gnosis chain, had said if this works, the Gnosis chain might come back and might transfer from an L1 to an L2. And why? What's the reason? Shared economics. You get to tap mm-hmm. into all of Ethereum's liquidity and right. this alliance can grow. So it's kind of a sum type story. A sum is greater than the parts type story because every L2 that joins adds some more liquidity and they all kind of share it together. So that's kind of the alignment hope. I don't know yet. It's too early to see whether they can pull it off, but the dream is still alive.
Yeah. This sounds like just based and native rollups applied.
Yep.
Is that what this is? Because I know Martin was big on native rollups. Is this that?
Well, it's funny because Martin gave the talk at the same DEF CON I was talking about yeah. native rollups, right? And so this is the manifestation of that. And he thinks now it's kind of possible. Maybe it's not quite native rollups in mm-hmm. the way he talked about them as being completely homogenous. But for all intents and purposes, it feels kind of like a native rollup. And the bottom line is united liquidity, united network effect. A much more coordinated ecosystem of chains. That was the original vision, and maybe this pulls it off.
I think the thing that I am still undetermined on, the jury is still out on, is this kind of like closer to a main quest line for Ethereum that somehow Martin from Gnosis is doing instead of the EF? Or is this more of another like technical side quest, intellectual masturbation kind of thing that we like to do in Ethereum?
It all kind of depends on traction, I think, right? Mm-hmm. And you mm-hmm. know, some have said like Zaki Manian from the Cosmos ecosystem, where have I heard this idea before? We tried this in Cosmos in 2023 and it didn't work.
Cosmos tried everything.
Yeah. Martin Koppelman says, to be frank, being in the same economic zone as Ethereum is more relevant than being in the same one as Cosmos. So basically,
that was always our argument, which is like, well, Cosmos didn't have money. Like atoms were never money. ETH is money. And that's a material difference.
If this path catches on, it would be great because the EF can focus on scaling the L1. They can focus on getting Ethereum quantum secure, right? And the community can focus on efforts to unify all the chains. So maybe we get the best of both. But again, we'll have to see how this actually plays out in practice.
I do like saying the ETH is money words because what would be, Ryan, the native currency of the Ethereum economic zone?
Well, you know, right? Every united country, I suppose, has a single currency, so it would have to be ETH.
It would have to be ETH. Speaking of things that make ETH money, Aave V4 is now live on Ethereum. So we've been at Aave V3 for a while. V4 has been in development and is now deployed. Some of the biggest changes is that V4 turns Aave from a collection of independent lending pools into a single liquidity hub that has specialized lending markets called spokes to plug into the hub. So each spoke has its own underwriting rules, collateral types, specializations, etc. And also the idea is that anyone can launch a spoke with DAO approval, and all of the spokes just plug into the hub.
So shared liquidity, but how does risk work? Like if some pool kind of like, or some spoke, you know, the debt goes bad or something, it's a bad asset, something bad happens.
Right. Okay. So this is the toxic contagion model. So if some spoke is like, let me allow for some terrible token to be collateral. What was the Sam Bankman-Fried token? FTT. Let me allow FTT to be collateral.
Yeah.
Well, first, I'll answer that question in a second. First, there is a risk premium different for tokens.
Okay.
And so in V4, if you, Orion, are collateralizing Ether to borrow USDC and I'm collateralizing FTT, the Sam Bankman high concentration, low float token,
yep,
Aave will charge me as the FTT collateralizer a much higher premium than you for collateralizing ETH, because ETH is money and FTT is a scam.
Okay.
And so first there's like one defensive layer off of that. Second, there are credit lines as like blast radius constraints. And so the credit lines are created by the hubs to govern the spokes. They set limits and conditions for borrowing. And so Aave is the main risk manager of the hub, and they will govern over the size of the collateral, the size of the credit limit, which constrains the damage any one spoke can do. So it's a little bit of a trade-off. It's not completely constrained, but it is balanced between the two ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a big deal. Now, they're starting small. I think there's some limits on how much can be added to Aave 4 right now, but I'm sure they'll take those limits down as security is proven and time goes on.
It is worth highlighting that the explicit intent is that users never really interact with the hub directly. They interact with spokes. Not dissimilar from the layer two model. Remember when we were saying like users go on the layer twos?
Mm.
This kind of, to me, Ryan, mimics central banking, where you have the hub, the central bank that governs the spokes, the commercial banking
banks,
layer,
yeah.
And it determines the interest rates, you know, who's got the money, all this kind of stuff. And so users go to the spokes are the commercial banking layer, and then the spokes are governed by the hub. And so this is Aave going into like a platform model.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. I mean, this is a big network effect game, right? And so Aave is leaps and bounds ahead of their nearest competitor. And it seems like a plan like this, they'll remain so if they can execute on this. David, it looks like X is clearly working on a crypto app. Maybe call it a money super app. We have Benji Taylor, who just announced he is joining X. He's got a photo here with Elon Musk. This is Benji. If you don't know who Benji is...
I do not know who Benji is. Who is
so
Benji?
This is the guy that built the wallet that got poached by Aave. So he built a crypto wallet that was purchased by Aave, and they've rolled it into a consumer product. Then he was...
poached by Base.
Oh, yeah. Then he was poached by Base. So building wallet stuff there. So it's all crypto stuff, all wallet stuff.
Uh-huh.
And now he is working for Elon Musk. An X.
So he just, hey, do you have a wallet that needs built for your money app?
Yeah.
I can build that for you.
Exactly. And I'm sure X was like, hey, we need some talent to go build us a crypto money app wallet. And so they went and they picked up Benji. That's a sign of things to come. Meanwhile, you have Phantom and some of our crypto native wallets coming steps closer to building their own money super wallets. Starting today, this is Phantom. Anyone in the U.S. can fund with bank transfers or Apple Pay directly to a Phantom wallet, send and receive wires. That's a bank feature in a DeFi wallet without Phantom fees. And then Phantom has a debit card. There's another convergence happening here where crypto wallets are becoming a bit more TradFi friendly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, especially when we got the doors blown open by the CFTC and the SEC about financial super apps. Like we have the green light and now the race is on to build the Phantom super app.
Absolutely.
Something that caught my attention this week, Apex is now building on Base, APYX. We learned about this actually through our conversations with Michael Saylor. We recorded with Michael Saylor yesterday. That episode is going to come out in a week from Monday. So premium subscribers get it like 10 days earlier. So if you want to go listen to that episode, you can subscribe to Bankless, get that in your podcast feed. Apex is bringing Strategy's Stretch product, their yield-bearing $100 pegged equity instrument that spits out, I think, 11% yield right now.
11.5. Yeah.
And it's putting that on Base. And so we have Strategy, which buys Bitcoin. Puts it into its equity holdings behind MSTR.
Yeah.
Issues another equity instrument called Stretch.
Fixed income instrument.
Variable, because it flexes up and down.
Yeah.
It used to be 8, now it's 11.5.
Right.
It's got $6 billion of AUM right now because retail just loves this product. And then we have Apex tokenizing that equity instrument and putting it on Base.
Okay. So we took a digital asset, we converted it to a security, then we took that security and we tokenized it and we put it back on chain.
Yeah. And we issued another security in between those steps. You missed one
cool.
of those steps.
Cool. Yeah. Innovation. Yeah. I mean, if this is what the market wants, right?
So, DeFi loves yield. Stretch is yield.
Best of breed. Best of all things.
I don't hate it.
But the market
it.
Will figure this out. David, you know, OpenAI... just closed $122 billion raise, and the valuation was almost $900 billion dollars. This is a company that just released a product, what, like 3 years ago?
Yeah.
Fastest growing product in history.
Mm-hmm.
$2 billion revenue per month, growing at 4x faster than when they raised at $157 billion. That was the last time they raised. These private valuations are gargantuan. So this is still a private company. There was some other news on the week that SpaceX, they are targeting a June listing at a $1.75 trillion valuation.
Wow.
Now, this would be an IPO, okay?
Yeah.
So a company goes from zero to $175 trillion completely privately, and then it IPOs to dump on retail. No, I'm sure it's a great company, but like, after all of the upside has been achieved privately.
It's hard to get excited about $1.75 trillion valuation.
It's cool. This is also such an indictment of our public markets today in the US, which is the vast majority of the growth, the most exciting companies, the decacorns and future unicorns are now
private.
Happening privately, and retail does not get accessed because of accredited investor laws. So Amazon, contrast that, 1990s. Amazon, if you bought it at IPO and held all the way to now, that would have turned, let's say you had $1,000, you did that, $1,000 into $2.88 million. Okay? Mm. Almost a 3,000x return. Returns like that just like aren't existing as these companies are IPOing later in the cycle.
Yeah.
So, cool. And also, I'm pretty frustrated by that.
You're sent Ryan's a little butthurt.
I couldn't get in either of these companies.
Ryan, I've got some breaking news for you on the backs of the OpenAI news.
What's that?
This happened just a moment ago. OpenAI has acquired TBPN.
Oh, really? The media company?
Yeah. That just got announced. The media company out of LA. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. What are they doing with them? I mean, obviously, it's a very cool media company to own.
Yeah.
I don't quite see synergies between TBPN and
OpenAI.
You sure
about this? This isn't like a remaining, April Fool's joke, is it?
Leftover April Fool's. The date on the blog post on OpenAI.com is April 2nd, 2026.
All right, we're safe then. If it's April 2nd, we're safe.
It's a bad April Fool's joke if it's April Fool's.
Let me tell you, man, there were some good ones. Like, I enjoy April Fool's. I just like it. It's fun. MetaMask had a good one. They had they released MetaMask TradFi mode, which you can activate on your wallet, and like it slows everything
down. The app shuts down at 6
p.m. Yeah. Banker hours only. I thought that was pretty clever. Did you see anything that was good?
Well, I think, Ryan, we do a bang-up job with our April Fool's jokes. We have a history of pretty good April Fool's jokes. Our April Fool's joke this year was that we did an IPO on Canton Network, which is like just believable enough that it got enough people.
Yeah.
We were like, some guy was in the reply saying like, I sent this to people in a furious rage.
No way.
And
really?
I
remember some of our previous ones. Like one time we announced that Bankless was acquired by Wells Fargo was full.
Yeah,
like
we lost 1% of our email subscriber list.
We lost community that day.
People were furious at us.
Well, that does bring the question of like, can you push an April Fool's joke too far? I think there were some crypto protocols that maybe did that. What? You tweeted about this Hyperbridge?
Dude. Yeah, I'd never heard of this before. And granted, this is a victory for them because now I've heard of them before, but they are a bridge. I think to Hyperliquid, they are a bridge. And they tweeted out, we've been hacked. We're working hard to fix this.
This is a terrible
April Fool's
If you
joke.
Are a crypto protocol, do not tweet on April Fool's
There
you've been
is
hacked.
A unspoken but should be spoken rule of if you are a crypto protocol, if you're a crypto company, you do not make April Fool's jokes that are related to customer funds.
Yes.
Or move the market.
Yes.
You do not disturb markets with your April Fool's
jokes.
Use
some sense, people.
Use your, God damn it, people. Ugh. Jesus Christ.
All right. Well, we got to end it there. Of course, you know, April Fool's is risky. So is crypto. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.